Good morning. The Honolulu City Council voted to override Mayor Caldwell's veto of the Sitlai expansion into two additional downtown malls. We'll talk with Councilmember Joey Manahan about what happens now. At the nexus of political conviction and faith, you'll find Dr. Willie Parker, the advocate for women's reproductive rights, flies into southern states to provide abortions. He joins us this morning. And later, we'll check in to see what's taking Neil Conan's attention this week. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Comic books are serious business and serious art these days. We'll talk with Hawaii Comic Book Alliance founding member Sam Campos. And Manoa Valley Theater's In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play, is a comedy and much more. We'll hear from director-choreographer Victoria Gale White.
That's the conversation for Thursday, September 3rd. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
The ongoing discussion of Sitlai.
And what happened yesterday, and that's going to be what we're going to talk about first thing this morning, because now we're watching it expand, and what happens from this point is also in the mind of the council. Let's take a look. Now, there was no surprise yesterday in the Honolulu City Council vote. By a margin of 7-2, the council did what it said it would do, override Mayor Caldwell's veto of the Sitlai ban to include two additional pedestrian malls in Chinatown. The mayor cited questionable constitutionality and tax dollars that will likely be used to litigate if that happens. Council member Joey Manahan was in the majority in yesterday's vote. He's in our studio now. Thanks very much for coming in.
Aloha. Good morning, everybody.
Now, the council says that this wasn't about targeting the homeless, but it was about protecting business. But those protections, including, you know, the access to business, seem to be running a lot longer than business hours. So how does that not target the homeless?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the council is basically looking to Sitlai to be able to manage encampments, which we're finding out outside of Waikiki. That's what's happening with the homeless folks, unfortunately. When we were legislating Sitlai for Waikiki, we were worried about targeting the homeless because we were worried about homeless folks impeding access on the sidewalks. And so we would have to be really careful in terms of enforcing Sitlai that we're not targeting homeless versus somebody like a street performer in Waikiki. But outside, unfortunately, you know, encampments is the way homeless survive, but, you know, they're also very dangerous in terms of public health and safety.
So what happens with the malls now, which are clearly not sidewalks? I mean, you've got a lot of space in there. The idea of protecting the businesses that are there, but when those businesses are closed, not allowing homeless people to be there, is doesn't that sort of just continue the cycle of, you know, kicking them out and then putting them someplace else or having them go someplace else because there really isn't a place for them to go, although council members seem to be talking about looking for places in their own districts where that might happen? You're still talking about a long time out. What happens in that gap?
Right. Well, let me just say, and I think I found this on the council, you know, whether it's a mall, whether it's a sidewalk, whether it's in Waikiki or Chinatown, I really don't think that's what people care about so much. I think more than anything, you know, what they see us doing is expanding the Sitlai provisions to areas where, you know, the council, it is justified, I think, because, you know, it is a public health and safety issue. But, you know, what the public sees is just us expanding Sitlai without talking about housing, without talking about transitional shelter expansion, or now, you know, looking at the possibility of safe zones.
The leadership team that the governor has pulled together is, in fact, talking about that. And they're trying to get a process happening in a way that we haven't really seen before. Does what the council has done now and potentially looking to do it again, does that thwart this process?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think so. You know, I think that, first of all, that our actions were justified, right? But yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult issue. It's not a one size fits all, definitely. But I worry about you know, I worry about us on the council, and I'm sorry, could you repeat
that? Well, just looking at the fact that you've got a process that's now started. The mayor is part of that process. Looking at how even Kaka'ako is being looked at, and with the notices that went out on Tuesday and enforcement to begin on next Tuesday, but that's for a very narrow area, and he has said, well, you know, until this area is completely clean, we're not going to move into another area. It's going to be phased. The sense of we're trying to move out as many people into housing as possible, working within that leadership team to do that, and the outreach and, you know, the providers who have been trying to make that happen, so that there's a place for people to go. They're simply not being pushed out and known that if you push them down here, they're going to pop up someplace else.
So back to the question about the hours and the, you know, when we the preferred method of enforcement right now is called SPO, Stored Property Ordinance. And basically what that does is give people 24 hours notice to move their stuff before the sweeps come. And, you know, that's become such a routine cat and mouse game that we're playing between law enforcement and the folks who are living in these homeless encampments, unfortunately, that, you know, it's become a routine, and people know that they can go back and camp out there for a couple of weeks before the next sweeps come. So we need to get beyond Stored Property Ordinance. We need to get beyond SITLI, and we really need to start talking about shelter expansion and the possibility of safe zones, and which I've never been a proponent of. However, you know, I mean, there is an immediate need, especially for the children and the families who are out there. But I also want to point out that, you know, the council is frustrated because we've appropriated over $140 million towards this effort, and the administration also hasn't spent the money. They've only spent about $10 million in terms of building a new housing. And so that's also what we're questioning. But definitely, I really think we need to move beyond the discussion of SITLI, start talking about safe zones, but also start talking about the implementation of Housing First.
As all that talk is happening, and as good of a talk as it may be, you still have the reality of people. Right. And you have families, and you have single, you have all kinds of people who are out there. Yeah. The real question is then to stop that revolving situation that you just talked about. How are you going to proceed? What is the council looking at doing in that interim time? How do you do something within that gap?
And you're absolutely right, Bethan. I mean, no, there's no housing that I see that's going to come online, at least within the next year. So we do need to do something about the families, especially the families with children. I think those are the most immediate needs. But yeah, I mean, you know, given the choice between an encampment and a safe zone, and I would differentiate the two as one of having rules and one without having rules. You know, the encampment does not have any rules. But yeah, I think we really need to start talking about safe zones.
And finally, at what point do you think the council will be satisfied that it has done enough with SITLI?
You know, I personally, I've had enough with SITLI. And I think, you know, if we take up the issue again, it should be island-wide, because it's really a painful process.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thank you for coming in this morning.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Honolulu City Councilmember Joey Manahan represents District 7 and chairs the Committee on Transportation. Yesterday, he voted with the majority to override Mayor Caldwell's veto of Bill 44 to include two Chinatown malls in the SITLI ban. And if you want to talk about this issue, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's now 12 minutes after the hour of 8. Coming up, the amazing Hawaii Comic-Con. We'll be talking about it with one of its founding members. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a look at William G. Irwin Memorial Park, which celebrates its 85th anniversary today. Constructed in 1930, William G. Irwin Memorial Park is a two-acre park located Mauka of Aloha Tower Marketplace in Honolulu. The history of the park can be traced back to Irwin's daughter, Elaine Irwin Fagan, who donated the land Irwin Park sits on to the territory of Hawaii with the stipulation that the property honor her father and be maintained as a public park to beautify the entrance to Honolulu Harbor. If you aren't familiar with the park's namesake, William G. Irwin was a Hawaii businessman and public figure known to be a close friend of King Kalakaua, who went as far as making Irwin a member of the Privy Council of Hawaii in 1887. Among many other things, Irwin had a hand in opening the Bank of Klaus Spreckels and Company, which was later incorporated under the name Bank of Honolulu. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you tell us where in Hawaii Irwin attended school. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, proud to help fund construction of the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodge in Hawaii, a place for Hawaii's cancer patients and their caregivers to stay. Learn more about Mattson's giving at mattson.com.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man.
Those kids who doodled comic book figures in their school notebooks may end up having the last laugh, at least some of them. Sam Campbell's got scoldings in school for his first efforts, but now he's a working comic book artist as the creator of Dragonfly the series and Pineapple Man, and one of the founders of the Hawaiian Comic Book Alliance. It's a growing hui that has a couple of gatherings coming up, and Sam is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Sam.
Aloha, good morning.
This has become quite a local scene, you and other comic book artists, right?
Yeah, it's about time, I think.
Well, it's been growing for a long time. When did it start for you?
For me, high school, when I was in Kahuku. I used to sit with a bunch of friends, and our big thing that we used to do was catch the bus, go to Jelly's, and buy a bunch of comic books and read them on the way back to Kahava. So that was a big thing we used to do in high school. And then when we were in art class, instead of following what the teacher did, we did our own thing. And then we finally got busted. And the end result was Pineapple Man. Kind of funny.
Well, yet I see an awful lot of, it wasn't just doodling. I mean, and I see your contemporary work. There's a lot of technique that you kind of have to get out of art class or somewhere. There's a lot of real skill involved here.
I always tell people there's two types of artists. There's natural talent, and then there's guys like me who have to work extra hard at it. So believe it or not, it doesn't come easy for me. I really had to concentrate.
Well, what did you concentrate on? I mean, how do you get those kind of draftsmanship skills?
I think, I'm going to have to blame Star Trek. Really blame Star Trek. When I actually started to learn how to draw, focus on it a bit, one of the things the teacher told me was pay attention to light and shadow, and he mentioned Star Trek. And Star Trek was running on KHNL back in the day every night, and there's lots of lighting and shading and stuff like that. And then I started noticing with how the light was on the characters, the actors, I also noticed how the shots were set up.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of got me interested in, and I watched a lot of movies, I guess, at the time. And a lot of times people, they see a movie that they like, and they know instantly that they like it, but they don't know why they like it.
Right.
And part of that has to do with how it's set up and how it's lit and how it moves and how the story flows. And I just kind of stumbled upon it by accident. And that's how I learned, just from observation.
When I look at some of your images from Pineapple Man, one of the things that's very clear and often the brightest spot in the composition spots are the eyes of the characters.
Well, the eyes tell a lot. With Pineapple Man in particular, I mean, he's got these huge white eyes, and that's a nod back to, Hawaii culture.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he's got the name Pineapple Man, he's really not a pineapple. He's got what we call the warrior's gift given to him by the Hawaiian god of war, Kukailimoku. And what Ku did was give him super strength and powers and kind of recreated him in his image a little bit. I probably should have changed the color scheme, but it was working for me, so I stuck with it.
Well, no, it seems to work really well, but you also have that thing that you have with the comic book character, kind of this convention of the character who acquires extra power and then goes out kind of as a fighter for justice. There's a very sort of clear, through line to where your characters are going, yeah?
Right, right. The hero's journey, I think that's what they call it.
I'm sorry, say that again, Sam?
It's the hero's journey, I think that's what they call it. I kind of wanted something for Hawaii that, you know, hadn't been done before. Because, you know, growing up, every time we're basically, you know, we're props in the background and stuff like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, you watch cartoons and Scooby-Doo, and it was kind of silly. And my encounters going to the convention in San Diego back in the early 90s was they asked me how I liked, you know, being in the United States and that kind of thing. And do we really run around half naked? You know, which is true. We do run around half naked, but not how they think. So by taking this character, I wanted to make something that hopefully had enough grit and depth to it that it could stand up toe-to-toe with any character in any universe, mainstream or not.
So there's a real kind of there has to be more than just creating a character and having him fight bad guys. He has to be going in a certain direction.
Correct. For him, the story of Pineapple Man is a story of redemption. He was a bad guy at first, and all the things that he ignored growing up as a kid. Because I know for myself, a lot of kids rejected Hawaii. They rejected the values and stuff that were here. And, you know, years later, you find out that the same kids I remember that were complaining about Hawaii, they moved on, and all they talk about is how much they miss home. So I guess I kind of saw that coming, and what I wanted to do with this character was he'd forsaken everything here, and whether he believed in it or not, it was right there in front of him, and he had to deal with it. So that's kind of the theme that I have going on.
Most of the references that you've got, that you built out of, are really sort of from things, you know, they're directly from pop culture. They're not from novels. They're not from fiction. It's a whole different way of looking at things. Yeah, mm-hmm. Where comic books, Star Trek, that's kind of been your world in forming your art, yeah?
Yeah, it's, you know, good storytelling is there. And it's funny, I was reading an article about Star Trek this morning, coincidentally, about why it's endured so long. It's because of the, you know, the subject matter and the integrity, you know, behind the characters and stuff like that, and the optimism, you know, that despite, you know, whatever horrible situation you're in, you know, you can persevere and endure, and, you know, there's always a chance for a brighter tomorrow. I think that's kind of what's inspired me, and I think that's what a lot of people strive to do.
The optimism is, I would think, would be extremely important, because you have to have a conflict to get your story off the ground,
yes.
but you can't have it, have everything be a downer, yeah?
No, yeah, can't be.
As you look forward to, there are a couple of these Comic Con conventions coming up. There's a whole community building around this whole culture, isn't there?
Yes, it's incredible. So for many years, San Diego Comic Con has been the go-to place. There's San Diego, there's Wizard World, and I think there was another one, which I can't remember. New York, I think it is. And, you know, people from all over the world fly to these conventions. You know, I've done it myself. I know a lot of friends that do it annually. And Hawaii Con came about. And, you know, I guess for years we've had stuff in Honolulu that's tried to go, you know, here and there. And this hasn't been met with the success that it needs to get. So I always try to support, you know, any type of local endeavor, especially in the creative field. So Hawaii Con came about on the Big Island, and they created this convention, sci-fi comic convention, which is different than anything else. It's set up to be like a vacation. You get to hang out with your favorite creators, actors, voice actors, you know, just people from NASA, scientists and stuff like that. You get to hang out with them for a weekend. And the environment that they've created at this convention is so relaxed. I've worked with a lot of actors and stuff in Hollywood, which comics led me to, and I've seen how the actors are in public. And
Sam,
watching these actors show up the first day for the convention, and they're not sure exactly what they're getting into. By the end of the day, they're totally relaxed, and they're ready to mingle, and they were just, they all, pretty much everyone I encountered from Hollywood to told me that it was the best convention that they had ever gone to.
Well, Sam, we'll look forward to that. Thanks for talking with us this morning.
That's next week already.
Yeah. Wow. Sam Campos is the director of Dragonfly, the series, and Pineapple Man. He's one of the originators of the Hawaiian Comic Book Alliance. Hawaii Con Big Island will be held at the Hapuna Prince Beach Hotel from September 10th to 13th, and the Amazing Hawaii Comic Con will be held at the Hawaii Convention Center from September 18th to the 20th. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Football gave my dad a life.
On the next Radio Lab.
Brutality.
Cult of manliness.
Strongest, toughest wins.
Full-on contact football at 4.
Kicking, there's biting, there's gouging.
Yes, my son is a beast.
No one seems to be stopping themselves from watching these games.
You guys are playing like a bunch of I'm like, whoa, they're 4. They don't even know what that is.
Football.
On the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10.
Whether it's a live performance by a local musical ensemble, a broadcast of a classic recording, or the specially curated programs from our local hosts, the music you hear from HPR adds richness to your day. Thank you to listener members Ann Inouye of Honolulu, Warren Sato of Kailua, and Velma Akinaka of Honolulu for making it possible for us to make music together. Play your part by calling our membership department at 955-8821 during business hours or click on support at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, honored to be named one of America's best banks by Forbes for 6 consecutive years. Learn more at boh.com/bestbank. Member FDIC.
Portable classrooms could see new life as a temporary Hawaii shelter for homeless people. That potential short-term solution came out of a recent meeting of the governor's leadership team on homelessness. The big question, even if the portables are actually repurposed, will any neighborhood welcome them? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair gives the idea a reality check today. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
There has been resistance when your other villages, I'm thinking about in Waimanalo, when that has come to be. But then, you know, we've gotten over that. And now it seems to be that they're a fixture. Is that possible for some of these newer developments that might feature these classrooms?
Well, I should caution that Governor Ige's team on homelessness, they're in the very early stages about talking about these portable modular buildings being used to house homeless temporarily. But the state actually does have 5 units that aren't being used currently. So I want to caution that they haven't decided where they might go. But you mentioned Weinberg Village in Waimanalo. That's a case where it did succeed. And Louis Kanea, in his report today, I had forgotten that back under the Waiheke administration, back in 1991, he actually pushed through these transitional villages. Now, having said that, others did not succeed. There was one in Haleiwa, and there was one in Waianae, and there are some lessons to be learned. One of the lessons is having it on state land, and that's one reason why the Waimanalo village has succeeded. You see it just as you're driving along the highway there, passing through Waimanalo, about 30 units. It cost about $700 for a 3-bedroom. Pretty good deal, but you've also got to pay attention to the rules on staying clean and sober.
So, I mean, all of this said that we've got to have housing. It has to go somewhere. Do we really need to have the conversation about getting over ourselves in various different locations around the state to be able to say we've got to have a place for people to go?
We're talking about NIMBY, of course, right? Not in my backyard. And I'll give a case in point. The city's been looking at putting something out on the leeward coast in Waianae. And one of the lessons that's come out is you really have to engage the community. You can't just show up, say, we're going to do this. You really need to work with people. Folks on the Waianae Coast Neighborhood Board, for example, were worried that, wait a minute, who are these people going to be? Are they going to help people that are, you know, actually from Waianae? That's one thing. But if you're actually going to take people from the city and bring them in, maybe that's not as appropriate. Don't forget, people are concerned about things like crime, drug use. So that is one very big lesson, is that you need to negotiate with the folks around you that are going to take, will be housing these temporary structures.
Well, we'll see how some of those conversations go and how they're affected and if, in fact, these portables get used. Thanks, Chad.
You're welcome, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
At the juncture of medical conscience and conviction of faith, you'll find Dr. Willie Parker. The reproductive advocate is known for as much for his profession of faith as his steadfast abortion care in places including Mississippi, where that care is otherwise unavailable. Dr. Parker is back in Hawaii this week, once he taught at the John A. Burns School of Medicine at UH, and he joins us now. Thank you for making time.
Thanks for having me.
There is so much about the conversation of abortion that has been so fraught with emotion as much as facts, and this conversation has gone on for decades. Do you see that there is something particularly missing in the conversation that we're having right now that might change or mitigate the way some people regard abortion?
Well, as you note, lines have been drawn, and there's not been a lot of space for common ground. I think we've lost the tone of civility with the ability to disagree, and the ability to disagree based on mutual embrace of what the facts are. The late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but no one's entitled to their own facts. So people are vested in their own opinions and to the point of winning at all costs. And so that's led to a disregard for the complex realities, let's say on the issue of abortion, about where abortion comes from and what prompts people to make that decision.
In that conversation about facts and obviously what prompts someone to make a decision like that, there are the realities that you see on a daily basis.
Yes.
Overlaid on that are also religious convictions by some people who say that they are listening to a higher authority and that trumps our so-called facts. You are also a man of faith, deeply held. How do you really make sense of that and try to embrace everyone without castigating anyone?
Well, I recognize full well that matters and issues of conscience and faith are personal, and as such they are sacred, and yet we all live in community, and as we live in community, our ability to think for ourselves means that some of us will reach different conclusions. So it's with that point of departure that I always stand with a baseline respect for the fact that people may differ with me on the issue of abortion or other things that are matters of conscience. But my respect comes from me understanding that that person is entitled to their belief. And starting from that place, it creates the tone for honest disagreement that can lead to progress, as Gandhi used to say. And it makes for a more civil and meaningful conversation, because if I'm not vested in winning the argument at all costs, I have to be willing to see your point of view. So I think that's what's missing from the compassion and the what religion, if it changes and alters how you see the world, it should leave you with the ability to embrace your fellow person even when you differ with them.
That's from your perspective, flipping that around and looking at those who look at you as being almost evil incarnate because of what you do.
Sure.
How do you continue on knowing that they don't hold those views that you do and that they might very well threaten your life?
Well, I take a lot of instruction and perspective from the civil rights movement, in particular Dr. King. Dr. King, even after being struck and injured by folk, being jailed, he refused to give way to hate. And he often told his followers that we do not have enemies, we have opponents. And I think that perspective allows you to always see the humanity and the universal brotherhood and the person, even when they oppose you. And so even though I know people deeply hold the values that they oppose abortion for whatever reasons they choose, I simply choose not to allow their opposition to me, even when it becomes venomous, to influence how I choose to view them and how I choose to conduct myself. So I simply choose to believe I don't have any enemies. I only have opponents. And so that leaves me also willing to work vigorously because I believe what I'm doing is right, even if other people don't agree with it.
At the moment, there are a number of opponents for Planned Parenthood, and in particular because of the videos that came out this summer, videos which have been edited. But even though that has been part of the discussion, there's always the point that, well, they might have been edited by so-called independent people who might have been, in fact, tied to the DNC. The counterpoint, all of that. Is there a point where you think where these videos can be instructive in advancing the case of not only fetal tissue, but reproductive rights for women?
I think that somebody once said there's no right way to do the wrong thing. So I'm perplexed by the notion that you can intentionally and deliberately miscommunicate, misrepresent, and be dishonest, even if your intent is to lead to a greater truth. So Dr. King used to say that the end has to be preexistent in the means. So I can't see a way where an organization that is ideologically driven that will intentionally misrepresent themselves to gather information that they can then alter and manipulate for the purpose of shaping a narrative that would lead to the defunding, in this case, of Planned Parenthood, and deny them the opportunity to provide the vital primary care services that they provide, because the effort to indict the integrity of Planned Parenthood as someone selling body parts in human tissue. I can't see where legitimizing an unethical approach to trying to illuminate an issue brings any light to the situation. It only generates heat.
Except for the people who will choose to believe that or believe anything, because people generally look for agreement, not necessarily a lot of facts to the contrary of what they believe. Is there any way, do you think, out of this whole situation that will bring or elevate the conversation?
I think seeing it through to its logical conclusion, when the National Abortion Federation sued the people who made these films, forcing them to, in a court of law under the rules of discovery, to invoke Fifth Amendment rules, it allowed us to put into context, you know, if you are being transparent, you wouldn't have to fear self-incrimination. So I think following this process all the way through and allowing us to see that lawmakers should not act on information that is ill-gotten will potentially serve as a deterrent to folk who think that this is an effective way to bring about non-democratic change in the future.
I wish we had more time to talk. We will. We're going to be actually sitting down and recording an interview while you're here in town, and we'll be playing that on Town Square soon. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Willie J. Parker is a reproductive justice advocate. He's the former medical director of family planning of Metropolitan Washington, D.C., the assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Johnny Byrne School of Medicine, and a fellowship in family planning at the University of Michigan. He returned to his home state of Alabama and provides abortion care there and in Mississippi, Georgia, Chicago, and Pennsylvania. And we're glad that he was able to join us this morning. This has been a big week around the world with commemorations of the end of World War II. Yesterday, veterans and U.S. officials gathered aboard the USS Missouri with a ceremony to mark the 70th anniversary. That was a far cry from the huge marches over the past few days. No doubt, all of that has filled the thoughts of Neil Conan in the more quiet moments on his macadamia nut farm. As we do each week, we check in with Neil, and he's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
It has been, as we say, some week. Looking at earlier today, that Soviet-style military parade in Beijing. Last weekend, the anti-war protests by 120,000 people in Tokyo. Looking at it, just on the face of it, those two events couldn't be more different. But do you think that there's a connection?
Oh, yes, I do. This was really the first time the Chinese Communist Party had marked the end of the Second World War this way. As you noted, it's always been a huge moment in Moscow in Soviet days. And now, with those parades of troops and tanks in front of the Kremlin and, you know, American observers trying to figure out who was who in the power structure by figuring out where they stood on the Kremlin wall. But in Beijing, the big ceremonial has always been the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic, which marks the communist victory over the nationalists after the Second World War, when Chiang Kai-shek and his troops retreated to Taiwan.
So, but wait a second here. Why switch and put on this gigantic, expensive and flex your muscles kind of show?
Well, that's a good question. Up to now, the Second World War has been sort of uncomfortable for the Chinese communists for two big reasons. The first, of course, is they didn't have a whole lot to do with it. Nobody questions the sacrifice of the Chinese people. The best guess, something like 15 million people died in the 8 years in which Japan occupied much of the country. But the bulk of the fighting there was done by those hated nationalists under Chiang. And Mao and the communists pretty much sat out the war on the sidelines. And the other reason is that while China tied up a big part of Japan's army in prolonged and bitter resistance, China did not defeat Japan. The United States did. And that feeds into the narrative of a weak China, which has been in past centuries at the mercy of first Western and then Japanese colonialists.
But they're certainly not weak anymore.
Exactly. That was the whole point of that parade today. The party leadership wants to project this image of power and of strength. And while a lot of China's neighbors worry that this strength is aimed at them, Taiwan and Japan in particular, I think the real target here was the domestic audience watching this display on TV. China is powerful and strong, they were being told. It commands the respect of the world. Vladimir Putin was there watching the parade in Beijing. Even if the Americans did not show up, well, they're going to throw a steak dinner for President Xi Jinping when he goes to Washington in a few days' time. And all of this couldn't come at a more perfect time for the party leadership, which is shaken by economic problems and the stock market plunge in Beijing. Legitimacy, the party's legitimacy, its right to rule, has been all about growth and prosperity. The old line is, you know, the party says, you let us rule, we'll let you get rich. Well, when there are basic and fundamental questions about that, the party is now having the opportunity to wave the nationalist wand. We made China strong.
Good PR. But getting back to the top for a second, how does all this tie into the anti-war march this past weekend in Tokyo?
Well, the Japanese government under Shinzo Abe worries deeply about China's growing power. They think it makes them vulnerable, and they have issues of nationalism and national pride, too. Remember, Abe just 2 weeks ago told his people that, yes, terrible things happened 70 years ago, but It's time for Japan to stop apologizing and take its place as what he calls a normal nation under the post-war constitution imposed by the United States. Japan is a pacifist nation. It cannot send troops into combat except in self-defense. Abe has been pushing laws through the Diet to reinterpret this position that would allow Japan to fight in defense of what he calls its vital interests, let's say if its oil supply line was cut off, for example, or to join an embattled ally, which is everybody expects really means the United States. Now, this is hugely unpopular in Japan, where many people see pacifism as central to that country's national identity post-war. Weekly demonstrations started when these laws were proposed. They picked up steam when the laws were passed in the lower house of the Diet last July. Then this huge crowd on Sunday as the upper house debates these measures. The upper house is expected to pass them sometime this month.
Well, Neil, as always, I wish we had more time to talk, but obviously you've got a lot of time to think when you're over there on the Mackinac Farm.
I got to go pick some nuts.
And you got to go pick some nuts. Thanks so much. Talk to you next week.
Okay, Beth Ann.
Neil Conan is a regular contributor to HPR with the Pacific News Minute. That's part of his ongoing radio career, now originating from his Hawaii Island macadamia nut farm. We talk about how he combines both farming and radio in our weekly conversations from the farm.
Earlier in the show for our backyard quiz, we took a look at William G. Irwin Memorial Park, which celebrates its 85th anniversary with a ceremony this morning at 9:30. Built in 1930, William G. Irwin Memorial Park is a small two-acre park directly mauka of Aloha Tower Marketplace in Honolulu. Its origin can be traced back to Irwin's daughter, Helen Irwin Fagan, who donated the land. William Irwin was a Kauai businessman and public figure who was a close friend of King Kalakaua, had a hand in the opening of the firm that became a leading sugar agency in Hawaii. For today's quiz, wondered if he would tell us where he went to school in his youth. The answer is Punahou School. And thanks to Hawaii Pacific University's Chris Aguinaldo for the quiz idea.
And we had a winner.
All right.
Robert Visali knew the answer, called us in, and a T-shirt will be coming his way. Thanks so much for playing with us on our backyard quiz. If you have one, you can send it in too. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
Medical care for women has come a long way in the past century, but it's had a long way to go. As recently as the late 19th century, doctors classified any number of female complaints as hysteria and used electric vibrators to treat them. Sarah Rule's play, In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play, takes an absurd situation, mines it for comedy, and reminds us just how skewed society's perspective can be when the subject is sex. The play is the season opener at Mono Valley Theater. Victoria Gale White is the director and choreographer, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Chris.
This is a play that mines comedy from a pretty serious situation, yeah?
Oh, it certainly is. I think it's been going on for a long time, since the time of Hippocrates, the diagnosis for hysteria, but I think it's a wonderful treatment. Sarah Rule is an incredible writer, and she's taken a lot of historical documentation from Rachel Maine's book, The Technology of Orgasm, and some of the actual historical quotes in the play are actually coming directly from this book, from the 1800s. The play takes place in the 1880s up in Saratoga, New York, mm-hmm. and in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Givings, a doctor that actually could administer vulvular massage, mm-hmm. and the vibrator was invented around that time by Mortimer Granville.
Which was considered a medical treatment for what?
Hysteria, you know, in women, but also in men. It wasn't just a female disorder, but It was a cash cow, that's for sure. By the time
you defined how as just any kind of form of being unhappy with your life.
I think it was just frustration. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you mounting frustration, pretty much. I don't know how else. I don't know the medical terms of it, but that's how I would have defined it.
But it was a wide variety of complaints got put under that
umbrella. Oh, yeah, headaches and cramps and loss of vision and pain in your limbs. And, it was like everything, mm-hmm. just draw it all in. Oh, the diagnosis, the big umbrella hysteria.
So now here comes this machine.
Right.
And the doctor is using it for medical treatment and...
Right, electricity, it was invented by a man, and these doctors that had been doing this manual massage for a really long time to take care of primarily women, were now going to have a cash cow because they could do this thing in 3 minutes, and their hands weren't going to get tired.
And they had patients lining up to be
treated.
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes. And they could. What you could do in an hour, now you could do in 3 minutes. Woo.
How does this play out in the situations of the vibrator play itself?
Well, it has wonderful arcs. I mean, the characters are so layered and well-written by Sarah Rule. It's sort of the classic sexuality and love theme. What's the vibrator's just a metaphor, pretty much, for humans trying to get through this corridor. What do we really want? I mean, what I think we all really want is intimacy. More than anything. So having an orgasm isn't enough.
And there are characters who go through that
journey. Oh, yeah. It's a beautifully written play. I mean, it was up for a Tony Award when it was on Broadway. But she's been up for a couple of Pulitzers, and she's a wonderful writer. Just really fabulously layered. So, I mean, you could read the play once and get a lot out of it, but the more you read it, I think the more rich it becomes, how layered it is, and how something from the 1880s is still really relevant today. I mean, it's the same issue. So we have all the phones and all the stuff that's removing. We can connect globally, but we can't connect across the room, and we can't have an intimate relationship with another person. So,
is comedy a good way to delve into this issue?
Yeah, I think it's comedy. It's also very poignant. It's not just all, laughs, but it is comical because these women had no idea that they could actually have, orgasms with their husbands. That was just, in the 1880s, that was just funny. Are you kidding me? That's not going to happen. But,
you have to wonder when you see how, from our point of view, how misguided we were very recently. It also makes you wonder, okay, if we were that we didn't think we were misguided in the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we don't think we're misguided now, but how misguided are we without knowing it?
Yeah, I think it all just comes back to the same thing, it's the heart. I mean, what do you really want? What does a human really want? I think it's that connection. It's a heart-to-heart connection. And I have a wonderful, wonderful cast. I mean, I feel so blessed to be able to work with them. They're just fantastic.
Well, each member of the cast has a responsibility of conveying layers, right? Not just getting jokes across.
Totally, totally, yeah. So can I say who they are? Can I tell you
Might
the cast
well.
Is? I have Kevin Keaveney, Rasa Fournier, Therese Olival, Nick Myers, Allison Paintner, Cindy Ramirez, and Steve Royal. And those seven bring this whole thing to life. I mean, they're phenomenal.
Well, we'll look forward to the show.
Oh, please.
You excited about it?
I am so excited about it. Yeah,
excellent.
Totally.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Gale White is the director and choreographer of Manoa Valley Theater's In the Next Room Are the Vibrator Play. The production will run September 17th to October 4th, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University. Named a top 50 Best for Vets business school by Military Times for graduate programs designed to fit the lives of veterans and military professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Bag lunch season is upon us, and Andrea Nguyen joins us with a construction manual. It's for Vietnam's delicious banh mi sandwich. Forget the PB&J and join us. That's this week on The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
Good to be able to talk to Dr. Willie Parker.
Yes, and when Victoria, director of the Vibrator Play, came in, I said, you two have got to meet each other because their worlds sort of overlap. They're both talking about, you know, advances in how women were regarded in the world of medicine.
And what was appropriate in the context of a certain time,
right,
that now maybe seems laughable. But then that was, you know, real science. And there have been other incidents of that along the path of time leading us to where we are now, where some of those same issues keep resurging.
And some of the things that we take for granted now are actually very recent parts of our history. So what else do we have to fix that we may or may not understand?
Well, let's see if we can fix some of this stuff perhaps first along the
way.
There's
nice.
A lot of things to be done.
Yeah.
And we will have a longer conversation, as we mentioned to you after the segment with Dr. Parker, that we're going to sit down and have a longer conversation. We will broadcast that on Town Square sometime soon. So look forward to that. But for the moment, we got to say goodbye because it's almost 9 o'clock. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with UHERO's Carl Bonham. We'll get a recap of the Council on Revenues meeting.
And we'll have a live in-studio preview of the UH Mono's Fall Guitar Concert Series.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch about anything you hear on the show and how you feel about it, you can leave your comments on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or if you like social media, we're there too. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or get to me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of the Conversation. See you then.